I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe artist Jerry West. He is a distinguished New Mexico painter with a long career of painting and printmaking and teaching. And he has a new book now, published by the Museum of New Mexico Press, called The Alchemy of Memory. He will be doing a book launch at the New Mexico Museum of Art at the St. Francis Auditorium this coming Sunday, the 17th of May at 2 in the afternoon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. What a pleasure to be here with you.
It's a great pleasure to be here, yeah. And it's a great pleasure to see. I've seen your work here and there, but to see a book like this, First of all, it's very stimulating to make one want to see the paintings in their actual size. Mm-hmm. But to see your work stretched out in a book over many years is so gratifying. And one of the things that I love about your work is that it's so profoundly New Mexican, and it's so grounded in the earth and in the people at the same time.
I guess I could agree to that a little bit. I really sort of grew out of this earth, you know. I don't know what to say about that background. I had a father who was also a painter, and he got here from Oklahoma in 1924.
Why did he come to New Mexico?
Well, because his older sister, who was, we called her Aunt Etna, his older sister, was a school teacher in Oklahoma City. Even in those years, in 1924, she reads an article advertising this quaint little town in New Mexico called Santa Fe, where artists from the East and from all over were beginning to gather. And it was a little art colony that early, of course. And they were advertising it, and she was so eager to be around artists that she quit her job at the end of the semester, caught a bus, and came to Santa Fe. And immediately got in touch with people like Gus Bauman and Will Schuster and Gerald Cassidy and so forth. And then invited my dad to come out, and he was a very skillful guy and had done a little commercial art and painting and sign painting and time on the river boats and so forth. But he was also charmed by Santa Fe. Came as a working guy and got a job working at filling station down below La Fonda, and married my mother, who was an Ohioan, and that's a long, interesting story, but basically met a guy that was working in the same filling station, became a real close friend of Hal's, and invited Hal to come back and paint the barn with him when Hal was talking about going back and studying in New York.
Hal being your dad.
My dad. Later on, I just say that on that trip back to Ohio and then New York, he meets my mother. So that's how I have an Ohio mother, so to speak.
The book paints such an interesting picture of your own life, of New Mexico, of your parents, and of growing up during the Depression. And growing up during the Depression in rural New Mexico was a really different thing than being in the Depression in, say, a big city.
Can't agree with you more. I think we were really isolated, and it was and pretty cut off from the world. I mean, maybe a little radio that we had through those early 37, 38, 39. And that's about it. And it was just a little battery radio, ran out of battery periodically, but we did have a chance to listen in, you know, and hear Fibber McGee and Molly, that type of thing. And that was about it. But we were pretty isolated, honestly.
And pretty self-sufficient.
Yeah. My dad was a WPA artist. We moved out of Canyon Road in 1935.
What was Canyon Road like in 1930s?
Well, it was just almost indescribable. It was a little country road, you know, a dirt road, and that continued until 1950s, a dirt road. And we were the early part of Canyon Road, 524 Canyon Road, across the street from the old Dietrich trees and just shortly down from El Zaguan and places like that. And it was amazing. Percy Ortiz had a grocery store, and the old Gormley store was still there and very active and still selling pinons. That's sort of way before all of the things that happened in the 70s with Canyon Road. And years later, we moved out in 1935 because Hal got on the WPA and he needed a little more space. And so he found these old adobes that were sort of semi-abandoned, built as a homestead or something like that, and he would get permission to live in it and fix them up or whatever. So for a good 6 years, we lived in these little houses outside of Santa Fe, which is closer to La Cienega, and now it's just, which was real country in those days. 599, the road literally cuts through that old country where we were, which in those years was really pretty isolated, pretty amazing.
Now, you witnessed the Japanese internment camps, which are where sort of West Alameda and kind of below the current dog park, and some of those images appear in your paintings. What was that like?
I'll tell you my connection with that, and I'll try to be pretty brief about it. In 1940, Hal, being a WPA and connected to the Museum of New Mexico opened Puye. They had closed it down all during the Great Depression, but the museum decided to open their museum up at Puye, a facility that had been built by the Lafon Hotel people. It was a great move for our family. We got up there for one great year, and in 1941, of course, the war breaks out, and that wonderful adventure didn't last too long for all of us. And we came back to Santa Fe, and Hal, he was too old to go in the military, too ill, and so he got a job at the Japanese internment camp. Now, the Japanese internment camp went up very quickly in Santa Fe because the camp had already been built for the CCC, for the Civil Conservation, where all through the Depression, the guys would live there with their horses, their tools, and whatever, and go out every day to do projects around northern New Mexico. So I remember it even as a kid. My dad would drive us by every once in a while, and he had a few friends who were CCC guys and that sort of thing. Anyway, he gets a job right in February of 1942 when they opened it. And they opened it that quickly. All they had to do, of course, was build a barbed wire fence, build a few towers, and then they had these perimeter riders that would ride around. And as you know, it was a very special camp. It was run by the Justice Department and not by the immigration people. And so they moved men only, and most of those men that were moved into that camp were leaders of the communities. Bilingual, they were very intelligent, and I guess they represented a threat because, first of all, they were alien in the sense that they were never naturalized citizens. Many of them had come as early as 1905 and 6 and so forth, and many of them were like Presbyterian ministers and Buddhist priests and whatever. But they represented to the government a threat.
Because at least in their minds.
And in their minds, because they were all intelligent and they had connections with the Japanese people, and they did a lot of interpretation, you know, interpreting back and forth. And it was just an amazing period. And they all went in without any, you know, there were very few, there were no trials or... Well, they did have early hearings, citizen hearings, for the people that were sent there. The citizens would often say, these people are not a danger to the nation or whatever. But the military always overrode it, and they would just put them in. So, and they were there, incidentally, for a good 6 months after World War II ended in 1945.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And it took a long time, as you know, to get even recognition that there was such a thing as a Japanese internment camp in Santa Fe.
But meanwhile, you were a little kid.
I was. And I have wonderful memories of just Hal working there, and he wasn't well, but he would go and he'd climb those stairs up to those little towers, and he, being an artist, did a lot of sketches from it. You know, when I actually decided when we finally got it plaqued, my sister-in-law, Elizabeth West, was working for the library, and she was very connected to those things, and I hadn't even paid much attention to the politics leading up to that plaquing of that, but it was very contentious, as you know, because of the Bataan guys who were, many of them still living, and had, you know, very strong opinions about the Japanese and were not in a mood to reconcile anything, you know. But I had the opportunity, and Elizabeth suggested that maybe I go back to the drawings that Hal had left and maybe do a little booklet of my memories and Hal's drawings. And I did that just a few days before the opening. I took it to that opening, and the Japanese who were there were so thrilled to get that little booklet that I even had to make more, and I did it. And so for a short time, I became really connected with the Japanese Americans. Many of them sent me pictures and letters after that. And if I'd had the time, it probably would have been a good basis of a book, but I didn't do that. And anyway, that's what led me to make this painting. But I had to go back to Hal's drawings to actually get a sense of it. I can remember a lot of it, but Hal has some wonderful pictures from his vantage point of being in a tower.
We're talking to artist Jerry West. Did your father encourage you to be an artist?
Not really. I mean, I was always around it from the earliest days, because he did all of his printmaking, all of his lino cuts in a little living room studio, and you couldn't help but be around it, and I certainly drew. I was the one in the family who I couldn't write well, I couldn't spell and all those things very well, but I did have a facility for drawing, and I started drawing very early on in my early days, and I'm sure Hal encouraged me, and I probably mimicked some of his little drawings and that type of thing, and right on through the school, grade school, we all rode the bus many miles to Wood Gormley, and then Harrington, and Santa Fe High, and all those things. So all through school, I was certainly active in art in one form or another.
One of the things that you write about, and that some of the other folks who are writing essays in your new book, The Alchemy of Memory, is the fact that your dream life became a very important part of your paintings. And I was thinking about that, because in order to do that, first of all, you have to remember your dreams, and you have to have dreams that are worth remembering. How did that come to be? How did you start to do that?
It's kind of interesting, because I'd done graduate work, I mean, late on. I mention this only because I started out as a biology teacher, history and biology. In my first 2 years, I taught history, New Mexico history. Not a historian, but for some reason they wanted me at Santa Fe High, and so they said, well, I think you have enough social studies, classes that would qualify you to teach history. So I did. Had a wonderful time those first 2 years, and then I moved into biology. But, you know, after teaching, I as much as I love teaching, and I think I was a really good teacher in those early days and very active and liked the students so much, I had come back to Santa Fe, and I was beginning to get back into the art scene. My dad had left the family not very well, and he finally, when I went to college in 1952, he went to Santa Fe and got himself a little studio where he lived the last 16 years of his life on Canyon Road, in a building which is now Ernesto Mayan's gallery. But okay. He lived there in the old Vigil house, and he opened a little gallery. And in those early years, when I was coming back and was kind of reacquainting myself with Hal, my dad, because in the earlier years, there was a lot of contention. He wasn't that in favor of me going to college and all of those things. And so, but when I came back with a wife and my beginning family and my two little daughters and so forth, I just spent more time in the art community. Started drawing with Fort Ruthling down at the old museum, and I started going to shows and being in shows, and I opened a little frame shop in the back of my father's studio, and that kind of began to place me in the art community again. And then in 1964, I made a kind of a wild decision to, I had to either go on and do summer courses in biology and physics and all those things that they were pushing us to do. I also had a chance to go with my father-in-law, my wife's father, to Alaska and pan gold. Or I could go back to school.
And pan gold?
Yeah,
really?
Yeah. Bless his heart, he never made it. He died on the way. After I declined his invitation to go with him. But I had also gone that same year over to see Elmer Schooley, and I wanted to get into his printmaking classes and painting. And he accepted me. I had no undergraduate art, but I went for two summers. He had a very strong summer program for teachers and a graduate program. But the first 2 years I did undergraduate work, and I qualified myself to teach art. And so after three summers, I was actually switched from teaching biology to art. I taught one year in art in Santa Fe High, and then was invited to go to prep. And so I taught for 3 years at Santa Fe Prep. In the early years when prep was kind of a magical little school too, way up on Canyon Road where it began. But that's okay. And then after I then went for a whole year and finished my graduate studies with Elmer Schooley in Las Vegas, with great years. Elmer Schooley never really pushed me in painting. He loved my art and my printmaking, but he did not like my storytelling quality and my didacticism and that sort of thing. And he pushed me to be a very contemporary artist and try to get away from emotional content and all of that sort of thing. But I got through his program there and had a graduate show. But after that, I quit teaching and piled up with a fellow graduate who was also a teacher but was also ready to quit teaching. And so we started building. And also, we built kind of for 6 months, and then we'd try to do our art over the winter months. And I got to New York. I had a new woman at this time in my life who was a New Yorker and got me to New York and elsewhere in the world. But what I did notice that when I left the prairie world, I call it, the New Mexico world, I began to dream a lot. I mean, I'd always been a dreamer, even as a kid. But when I got away from Santa Fe on trips or in New York City, I had these intense dreams. And ironically, they were always about the turmoil or the greatness of my early years with my family in the prairie world. And many of them were so intense, I kept records of them. And I always thought that that was pretty amazing.
When you say you kept records of them...
I would write them down.
Oh, I was going to say, did you sketch them?
Yeah, I did. I would sketch and draw them and just put them aside. I never thought much about it. But I had the great opportunity that when I first got to New York, I knew even if I was going to be there for 4 months or 5 months with Elaine, I had to do something in the art world. And very quickly, I got acquainted, all by chance, with one of the great printmakers of New York, Robert Blackburn. He was a black Haitian who had come out of Harlem. He'd gotten to Columbia, and he, through the years, had started a cooperative workshop where he allowed printmakers from all over the world to stop in, pay a small fee, have rights to the presses and to the equipment. And it was just a really exciting time for me to be there and pay my little fee and work with the many New York artists that were coming through that thing. And it was from that that I began to do etchings, and many of them had to do with my dreams. And that was the first. And I just thought... And I incorporated these dreams of flight and whatever. And I did a series of... And then when I got back to New Mexico, after 5 years of that back and forth from Santa Fe to New York, I came back permanently, met Miradell Rubenstein, who was a very successful photographer and incredibly supportive of my work and very encouraging to do the serious side of my work. I got in touch with a Jungian therapist for whatever reason, for many reasons, but John Talley was a guy that helped me a lot begin to sort of understand the dreams. But he also encouraged me to try to use the imagery to actually as a launching point for my paintings. So I did that, and shortly after, I followed Miradell to Colorado, where she had a teaching gig at the University of Colorado. I took a studio down in Denver and had a studio and just kind of held up in that funny little studio for a whole winter. And during that time, I started to actually put in painting a series that I call The Prairie Night. Yeah. And I was given a show in a wonderful gallery here in Santa Fe, in which they gave me a lot of opportunity to do anything I wanted to do, paint the walls. I did three-dimensional pieces. I had a sound piece that I had done from old recordings. When I was a young teacher, I did a lot of recording on the old reel-to-reel. And I recorded Indian voices and Hispanics and rodeos and sounds of windmills and animals and kids and whatever.
And you played them?
And I wove all that together as a background piece and tape, which later on the Vosulkas, who you know very well, Woody and Stena, were so excited about that we put together a whole little piece around the pieces. Stena came out and photographed my pieces in the nature and in the arroyos and so forth. And then we did a piece which we called The Prairie Night, which with my sound piece and their photography, which was kind of wonderful. And the reason I talk about that in some length is because I think those paintings gave me the courage to continue to do that kind of in-depth, sort of a psychological landscape approach.
You know, it strikes me, I mean, everybody has the experience of somebody telling their dreams, and I think 95% of the time, listening to somebody else's dream is really not that interesting because you can't really find yourself in it, or you don't really know what they're talking about. But when it's translated into a visual medium, and presumably you're departing from the raw material to the extent that you want or need to, building upon
that,
it really is. I mean, your paintings are so evocative, and it really struck me. I mean, I was reading the essays by the various people. I mean, you've written in this new book, The Alchemy of Memory, mm-hmm. and several other people have too. I would not know even where to begin, how to put this into words, because it's so profoundly, to me, non-verbal and kind of mysterious.
Well, you know, I always, because it's a mysterious land for me, even at this period. It's just a great mysterious world. And I love that quality and try to infuse it in my paintings if I can. But the dreams, I thought, were also a little bit humorous. I mean, I had that dream of my brother Archie and me flying. But, you know, flight is a strange thing. As a kid, I flew in dreams very often, which I thought was a kind of an unusual thing. But the only way I could allow that to happen as a child, as a young guy, was to jump off of an arroyo bank. I mean, so even to launch myself in a dream world, I always had to get a run, jump off the bank, and then keep flying, which I thought was great. But now, as an adult, I hadn't had a dream for a long, long time. I'm a flight dream since childhood. And then my dad, who had been dead since 1968, here it was now in this mid-70s, and I have a dream of Hal pulling Arch and me, but to get a glider off the ground, you have to pull it, you know, with some kind of machine, either a plane or a vehicle. And he chose to launch Arch and me from the back streets of Juarez, Mexico, which is great. And I had spent time in Juarez and loved that city, but Hal had never been there. And to have him launch Arch and me in this old Chevy, you know, from the back streets was quite an exciting thing. And I can't remember Archie at the time, or I couldn't remember the launch. All I remember was the flight and the wind around my body and so forth. And then I looked over my shoulder, and there was Archie flying behind me.
And this is all in the dream?
All in the dream. Well, as an artist, you know, one has to... It's one thing to have a dream like that, but then to paint an image of it is a very difficult thing. But the wings, of course they're not aerodynamic, and we know that. You would not. But somehow, I went back to an artist that I really loved, was Jose Posada, and I found in his wonderful drawings a drawing of a great politician that had great promise, you know, and had flown very high and then fallen to the ground, you know, as many politicians do for one reason or another. And he had a drawing of this politician crumpled up with these wings, and his drawings of those wings were so magical that I borrowed those from Posada.
Nice.
It changed the color. Of course, Posada was a black and white lithographer, you know, but it was pretty amazing. So that's how it happened. And then once I flew over Juarez, I had a chance to invent anything I wanted to. The scenes of old Juarez or Furicalo's house, which is not in Juarez at all, but in Coyoacan. And I had an opportunity in Maridal, and I had spent time in Frida's house. So I put that in just for the fun of it.
Were you aware of and influenced by different kinds of surrealism?
Oh, surely. Yeah. I mean, not so much surrealism, but I certainly influenced by the Mexican muralists a lot.
Yeah.
And
by Garcia. Kahlo.
Yeah, and I actually loved, and I think at that period I was doing a lot of reading of Garcia Marquez and a hundred Years of Solitude. It very profoundly influenced me to kind of infuse my paintings with that same kind of magical quality, from real history and honest history to something that was kind of magical.
We could talk all day.
Oh, yeah, we could.
But it's time to go.
Thank you, Mary Sharon.
Jerry West is an artist. His new book, published by the Museum of New Mexico Press, which is a wonderful press, and it's a beautifully done book. The book is called The Alchemy of Memory, and this Sunday from 2 to 4, there is a book launch and signing at the St. Francis Auditorium in the New Mexico Museum of Art. Then on May 22nd, there's an opening of a selective retrospective from 5 to 8 at Phil Space, which is at 1410 2nd Street here in Santa Fe. And then on the 4th of June from 5 to 7, there's a gallery talk. The Phil Space website is philspace.santafe.com.
Yeah.
So you can go there for more information. And Jerry, I just want to thank you for being with us in the Radio Cafe and for your amazing contribution to the art and culture of New Mexico.
Thank you, Mary Shelley. It's been a pleasure.